In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
A South Dakota classic gets the nod from James Beard. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, July 2nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the James Beard Foundation acknowledges the classic styling of the Pheasant Restaurant in Brookings, South Dakota. We'll talk with Michael Johnson about the journey to Chicago to receive the prestigious medal on behalf of his team. Not everyone is thrilled with South Dakota's new Medicaid enrollment system. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has that story. We'll consider the impact of U.S. Supreme Court decisions on the lives of teachers for a special teacher talk. Plus, a Native Pop recap, South Dakota swimmers vying for the Olympic team, and how much suffering is enough for a kid from South Dakota trying to find his way. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's talk about the James Beard America's Classics Award. It is a prestigious culinary prize designed to celebrate locally owned restaurants that serve quality food, have timeless appeal, and reflect the character of a community. Well, what is more timeless than an 8-foot pheasant statue, a sophisticated dining room, and an iconic Upper Midwest menu? The Pheasant Restaurant and Lounge in Brookings was anointed at the annual James Beard Awards ceremony in Chicago earlier this month. Michael Johnson returns to In the Moment with an update from the national stage. Michael Johnson, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I watched a lot of the full awards ceremony for the James Beard Awards this year online. And I was just so deeply moved by how chefs and restaurateurs and the hosts talked about the restaurant community, the power of food to connect and to represent identity, to give people an anchor in a community. Take us behind the scenes to your journey to Chicago and tell us a little bit about your experience.
Yeah, so it's a very eventful time. It's not just, you know, that one ceremony. There are leadership awards and media awards and all sorts of things. And, you know, the James Beard Award is a really amazing organization that does a lot to support food culture. They celebrate and support, you know, in their words, talent, equity, and sustainability. So like the day of the awards, we woke up early in the morning and went to advocacy forums for other restaurant industry folks and chefs and farmers and talked a lot about even some of the challenges that are facing us as we, you know, try to survive, you know, climate change and all sorts of, you know, workforce crises and just like everything you can imagine that has to do with how to stay inspired and keep feeding and serving your community and promoting positive change and all of the things that, you know, we were awarded for, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's very, very formal. And
yeah. I love the humility. We were awarded for, I guess. Yeah. Do you have this network going, this network going forward then of other chefs and other people throughout the national food culture community that you feel like you can learn from, contribute to, and stay connected with?
Yes, definitely. I met so many amazing people. And, you know, once you're awarded, you become a James Beard alum. And there are all sorts of connections and opportunities and resources available to you to make sure that you are maintaining sort of that standard of excellence, a good workplace for your team, that, you know, your team is what makes it happen. And facing all of the issues, you know, you kind of start out as just like a little fish and you're trying to do all these things and you don't realize that network is out there. And then you network and meet all these amazing people and, you know, there's more power in that connection to kind of like see the reality of some of the dreams that you thought were just sort of like pipe dreams when you're sitting around being an overly inspired creative type.
Tell me a little bit about Georgiana, your grandmother, and the the leadership from the mid-1960s, the vision that she had, what about her? And you know, she's calling the shots now. You're taking inspiration from her today. What are some of the things that you have learned from her that you believe are essential to the success of this restaurant and this team?
That's really hard to distill because, you know, I grew up spending a lot of time with my grandparents. You know, they, Ronald and Georgie, my grandma and grandpa bought the place in 1966, and they always had lots of things going on, lots of projects, businesses. You know, they were kind of the patriarch and matriarch of a big family. And all the little life lessons and work lessons and everything just kind of, you know, worked together. But, you know, it's about working hard, trying to achieve a standard of excellence, actually coming through with everything that you promise, you know, just making life good for the people around you and being very appreciative and supportive of your team, even if you have to kind of be the, you know, the driver and the manager and the, you know, person making unpopular decisions. She's always been very well respected and become like a friend or family to, you know, not only staff that have worked for them for a long time, but also to customers. And that culture has just really been something we've been careful to sort of, you know, maintain and nurture and grow.
Yeah.
So, it's still here.
Tell me what it was like to bring the medal back to your team. What were some of the things that people, because you can't take everyone out there. You got to go represent and return. What was the return like? Yeah.
Yep, I brought it right back and I said, hey, do you want to try on your medal? You want to wear your medal? And I just put it around everybody's neck so they can see what that feels like. And customers were asking to see it. So for a few days, a week or more, I learned that I just needed to have it in my pocket. Otherwise, I was going to have to run back and get it. I came back from the grocery store one day and realized I was wandering around Brookings with a medal in my pocket, which got some chuckles. But it belongs to the team, the community, all the generations, everybody who's done what they have to contribute to, you know, this thing that we are stewards of. So,
yeah. And it's all, how do you, you know, we got like 30 seconds left, but leave us with something about food and how, you know, why food? Why these classic dishes, the pheasant salad sandwich or the roast beef on.
Yeah.
I always forget what
so
they're
I just using. Feel like food culture, food, so many aspects of our culture around here are underrepresented and we're far too shy. And so it's just time to be proud and bring it out of the, you know, country church basement, out of the Wachipi out in the field, out of the, you know, on campus event, and bring it all together and be proud of it and let it live and be stubborn and adhere to your traditions. Because when people try it, they like it. But if they don't know it exists, they'll never be able to appreciate it.
I love it. Michael Johnson, congratulations to you and to every single person on that team. Thank you so much for being here with us to talk about it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right. We'll have you back again, I hope. After decades of use, the South Dakota Department of Social Services has unveiled a new Medicaid enrollment system. Officials say the system allows for more automation and creates a portal for applicants to log into. But as SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports, some people are expressing frustration with the new system.
There's just so many letters.
Anna shuffles between 8 different letters she's received from the State Department of Social Services. One of those is a termination letter she received in early May saying her Medicaid application was denied.
And so that like crushed my spirits at the time.
The very next day, she received a letter requesting more information for her application. The Rapid City resident is in her early 20s. She'd been applying for Medicaid coverage since mid-April. Anna started her application on the state DSS website, but she says when she reached what seemed like the end of the application, she was unsure if she successfully applied.
Like I said, there's no like, okay, your application has been submitted or anything like that. There's no confirmation, so I didn't know. So I wanted to just make sure it had gone through and I hadn't heard anything.
So she applied again. Unknown to her, she now had 2 pending Medicaid applications.
So I was getting letters and updates for multiple applications, but I had no idea.
Anna says she gets a letter from DSS about every 2 to 3 weeks, all related to the multiple applications she'd submitted. She says she went to the social services office in Rapid City and met with a caseworker.
I've been in there so many times. I've gone on their website so many times. It's like, why can't I just do this all at the same time, you know?
Anna says she worries the frustration she experienced signing up for Medicaid would discourage others who qualify from signing up for health coverage. A month prior to Anna's Medicaid odyssey, DSS launched its new benefits enrollment system called BEES on March 4th. It replaced a 40-year-old program. In June 2020, DSS contracted with Redmaine Technologies to construct BEES. Contracts with the Chicago-based company have cost the state about $96.5 million. According to DSS officials, in May of 2024, the average processing time for applications was 21 days, less than half of what the feds allow for. But some say the wait time for approval is taking much longer.
I have an individual who I helped them get Medicaid, and that was 2 months ago. They're still waiting for a determination.
That's Travis Johnson, a health insurance navigator for the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board. He assists individuals who are applying for Medicaid.
And they were told by the DSS office that they have to wait because they're backlogged. And I mean, to me, that's completely unacceptable. You have someone who's not covered but can't be covered by the marketplace because they unfortunately don't qualify.
Johnson says he uses the paper Medicaid application because he says the online BEES application feels incomplete.
It's not user-friendly for anyone. So whatever the driving force behind this design was, it's not working.
DSS Secretary Althoff said in a statement, BEES has experienced some software programming issues, but says the department is dedicated to responding to them. He says that's typical for any IT project of this scope. In the meantime, Althoff says staff members are available to assist applicants and enrollees either in person or over the phone. In a follow-up conversation with Anna, she says after weeks of not hearing from DSS, she found out by calling the department that she now has Medicaid coverage. I'm SDPB's Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The legal decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court have tremendous impact on our personal lives. Today, we begin a three-part series for our Teacher Talk segments. Educators Gina Benz and Jackie Wilbur are highlighting three landmark Supreme Court rulings that impact teachers today. From segregation to prayer in schools to First Amendment protections for students, if you're studying to be a teacher, it's smart to understand how the courts have changed how we educate our children. Now, each Teacher Talk conversation has a companion blog post, often with links to the research. You can find those on our website at sdpb.org/teachertalk. Let's begin in 1954 with Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Justice Earl Warren delivered the unanimous ruling. It marked the end of 60 years of separate but equal precedent established in Plessy v. Ferguson. Critics said the court had overstepped. Civil rights activists celebrated. Implementation became its own story. Gina Benz is a recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. She teaches AP English and other classes, including Teacher Pathway at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education there. We begin with Gina Benz.
So as a Teacher Pathway teacher, we have a unit that focuses on the history of American education. And of course, court cases are a huge part of that history. And I started thinking, well, what are the three court cases that seem to impact schools the most or get talked about the most? And I came up with my top three.
All right. Number one, Brown v. Board of Education. Tell us a little bit about the case and the story behind it.
Sure. This is 1954 in Topeka, Kansas. However, the entire case at the Supreme Court listened to was actually a conglomeration of five different cases from the East Coast and also from Topeka. But it's named Brown versus Board because in Topeka, the Brown family wanted their daughter to have the option to go to a school that was closer to them. And a lot of these cases that came together as Brown v. Board had to do with having the option to have busing, to have transportation, to go to a school that's closer to them. So it made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, where the justices decided that the Plessy versus Ferguson case, which said separate but equal, is okay.
In 1896, Plessy was, yeah.
That was damaging. Segregation was damaging to Black children, and so then they said that schools should be integrated, public schools.
All right, Jackie, so we're going to let listeners know that we're not lawyers.
Yeah, nor do I play one on TV
right?
or on the radio.
Yeah, we're not judges or justices. Mm-hmm. But as an educator and as someone who teaches education, this is a very familiar case to you. What do you want to add about the story of this case or the decision before we talk about really the impact and some of the surprising impacts of it as well?
Yeah, I think Gina's summary was excellent, and I'm looking forward to teaching a similar class to what Gina teaches in the fall at the University of South Dakota. So we'll have to be, Gina, comparing notes on how we discuss these pivotal court cases. But I think the thing I want to add to this conversation on the whole is really the importance of knowing our history as educators, knowing the way that we intersect with the Supreme Court, with legislation. All of those things come into your day-to-day work and have impact on how you do your job. So I think being informed is incredibly important so that you can stay abreast of why things are the way they are in the field of education.
So Gina, after this decision, there is a panic, a resistance, and a flight of white parents who do not want their students educated alongside Black students. They do not want their students educated by Black teachers or being led by Black administrators. So there is something called segregation academies, which start springing up largely throughout the South. Tell us a little bit about some of what happened after Brown v. Board that maybe we talk about a little bit less than we talk about the importance of desegregation.
Immediately after Brown v. Board, we didn't see schools right away jump into integration. In fact, some would say it took at least a decade, if not longer, for schools to get on board. And more court cases had to happen in order for laws to be made to really have the spirit of Brown v. Board realized. In these years after Brown v. Board, there were still a lot of segregation, and where the integration was trying to occur, certain families did not want to be a part of that. They did form their own schools, private schools. Colloquially or usually, they're known as segregation academies. Private schools were a way to keep segregation, and it wasn't until the 70s when the courts ruled that private schools as well could not segregate based on race.
All right, and that case is Runyon v. McCrary. Jackie, it's not ancient history. Talk about what happens during this time to Black teachers and the education pipeline. Places like Ohio State and Iowa State and Columbia University had educated many of these teachers, and they're sent packing.
So, yes, I think that's not something that's discussed as frequently when we look at this case, but there was the impact then of all Black schools, which had Black teachers and Black administrators. Now those students are going to different schools, right? And so there is a dismissal of a large population of Black teachers and Black administrators that previously worked in all Black schools.
What happens when, and I was looking up some of the numbers for this, and the numbers are kind of shocking with how many teachers, Black teachers, were forced out of education. Thousands litigated their pink slips, largely very few got their jobs back. Lost a lot of high caliber leaders, as well as an economic disruption to the Black community. But it also sets up some things that we are seeing ongoing debate about today, and I'm wondering if either of you have insight into the ongoing debate about public versus private schools and public funding getting sent to private schools. And again, you still feel the impact of that as educators in South Dakota in 2024, don't you?
I want to say just next door in Iowa, there is a voucher program. Mm-hmm. And so the government is giving families a certain amount of money so that their children can go to private schools. And that doesn't mean that the private school is entirely paid for by the voucher. It just means, you know, this is thousands of dollars to help you pay for your children's tuition. Government money supporting private schools, but not making them free. So not everyone still has access to the mm-hmm. private schools.
I'll add just in this conversation and reference an article that Gina talks about in the blog. There was an Education Weekly article in 2022 that talks about the impacts of Black educators from Brown versus Board. Mm-hmm. And at that time, like you were saying, the numbers, 35% to 50% of the educator workforce in the 17 states with segregated school systems were Black. And now across the nation, almost 80% of our teachers and administrators are white. So there was this very big shift in racial makeup of our teachers and administrators at that time. And I'm curious, I guess I don't have the numbers to see how that is implicated in private versus public, mm-hmm. but that is part of the conversation as well.
All right. So if you are a Black or Brown student thinking about becoming a teacher, mm-hmm. what are some of the things that you want to tell some of these young students, maybe in high school, in teacher pathway? Is there an open door or not? Because many of them would have never had a Black teacher.
Right. I was fortunate when I taught in Omaha to have Black administrators and Black colleagues, and I can speak to from my personal experience of just how much that enriched the culture of the school and how much there was a sense of trust and camaraderie with having folks who looked like the students be in leadership positions. I highly valued all of my colleagues that I worked with there. I also think that it is really important to look at the strong body of research that shows that having Black teachers and Black administrators benefits all students. There is a high level of research that indicates that that is true. So I continue to say that to young people, that even though you maybe have not had the privilege to have someone who looks like you be your teacher, it is very powerful to be able to be the teacher you wish that you had had. Mm-hmm. And so I really encourage people to go into this field, honestly, regardless of race, but especially if you're in a position where you could be a role model when you didn't have the opportunity and the privilege to have someone who represented your culture, your background in that role.
You know, there is a saying, you have to see it to be it. Mm-hmm. And so you're exactly right, Lori. When students don't see people who look like them as teachers, there's an unspoken message that gets sent. And anecdotally, in my own school, I see the impact that not just our Black teachers, but Hispanic teachers, Indigenous teachers have on students. And there's students who really look to these people as role models, especially because they share certain cultural heritage. So in recruiting, I like to often say to my students of color, do you wish you would have had a teacher who shared your culture, who had some similar experiences to you, especially with regard to race? And resounding yes. And so when I talk to these students of color, many of them have never even thought about being a teacher. Mm. They've never seen it. But the idea is appealing to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lots to celebrate in Brown v. Board of Education, too.
For sure. You know, it did send a really strong message that separate but equal isn't going to cut it yeah. in this country. And that diversity is a good thing, that we need to learn from each other.
All right. Any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I've got one more. Mm-hmm. I think there's a misconception that the Black schools, we'll say, at the time, just before Brown v. Board, were subpar, that those kids didn't have as good of an educational experience. And while that may have been true in some cases, in others, it was those Black schools were full of teachers and administrators who nurtured those students, who challenged those students. And they were, in many cases, very good environments. So it's mm-hmm. not a matter of the white schools were better than the Black schools. It was more a matter of just having choice and also convenience, right? Being mm-hmm. able to be bused to your school, your parents not having to leave work early to go get you from school, being able to actually walk to mm-hmm. your school.
Mm-hmm. And funding.
And funding.
Say more about that.
Just the additional funding that the white schools had based on the, you know, like how schools are funded to have the higher tax bracket in some of those instances, funding those schools then provides for more books, newer buildings, better playground equipment. All of those things are funded by tax dollars. So if you're segregating based on race, which at the time also segregated based on income level largely, that also had an implication for how much funding your school had.
Okay, well, then that's what we're still seeing today. There's self-segregation by moving to different neighborhoods, but we still do see schools that are largely students of color, schools that are largely white students, and that's largely because our schools reflect our neighborhoods. And if we continue to have neighborhoods that have just one, maybe two races, we'll continue to have schools that are that way.
Yeah. I have the privilege to work with so many school districts across the state and also the surrounding areas, but we have such strong relationships with rural districts, with the Sioux Falls School District, because we place our USD student teachers or teacher residents and field experience courses. Those students go out into all of those school districts. And I agree, there is sometimes this like preconceived notion about what a certain school district or what a certain school may entail. And every time, students are just blown away by what great things are happening in our school districts here. And so I think we have so much to be proud of in this state with what our teachers are doing and what our students are doing. And so I don't think there's room to speak disparagingly about any of our school districts because I do think so highly of all of them.
You can find companion blogs for Teacher Talk online at sdpb.org/teachertalk. Next week, the educators discuss the Pledge of Allegiance, school prayer, protests, and free speech as we explore a few of the landmark Supreme Court cases that impact teachers and students in today's America. Let's take a moment now to pack a little pessimism in the car for camping day. If you have a campsite reservation for the 4th of July weekend in South Dakota, pack your weather radio, watch the forecast, and get ready for rain. Dorothy Rosby says she doesn't need to check the weather. She knows a downpour is coming the moment she pitches that tent. Rosby is a Rapid City writer and humorist. She stopped by our Black Hills studios to perform her essay on camping in the rain.
100% chance of rain. There's only one thing more likely to cause a torrential downpour than me washing my car, and that's me going camping. If your lawn is drying up, just hire me to come pitch a tent in your yard. I used to think it was the tent's fault. My family used a variety of them over the years, and they were all waterproof, mostly. I've lived through enough droughts to appreciate rain whenever it falls, but lying on a sleeping bag all afternoon while puddles lap up against the sides of your tent tends to dampen your enthusiasm for both rain and camping. If I'm going to spend my vacation surrounded by water, I think I ought to be on a cruise. So, a couple of years ago, my husband and I built ourselves an ark. I'm joking. Actually, we bought a camper, which was easier. And on its maiden voyage, we learned that it wasn't the tent causing the rain, it was us. It's okay, though. Sitting in the camper during a storm is much more pleasant than spending the afternoon in a tent. For one thing, the Ark, as I affectionately call it, has a small kitchen. While rain may dampen my enthusiasm for camping, it doesn't dampen my enthusiasm for eating. The Ark has a bathroom, too. It's so small you can sit on the toilet and wash your hair in the sink at the same time, but it beats paddling to the outhouse in the pouring rain. It also puts an end to the perennial nighttime question of the tent camper. Can I or can I not hold it until morning? So, yes, I love our little camper. Not that it's perfect. For one thing, a lot can go wrong in transit. There was the day we arrived at our campsite at Sheridan Lake, opened the door, and discovered a puddle of dish soap all over the floor. Apparently, someone hadn't closed the bottle tight. I'm not saying who. And there was that time the battery died in the middle of the night at the North Cave Hills in Harding County. That set off a cacophony of beeping from the refrigerator and the smoke detector, which never happened in our tent. We've had to learn to conserve water because the ARC only has a 30-gallon water tank. It shouldn't be as hard as it is. None of our tents had water tanks at all. And while our camper is definitely bigger than any of the tents we've had, it's still tiny. It does sleep four, but you'd really have to like each other. And you'd probably like each other a lot less after spending a few days together inside while the rain comes down, which I can almost guarantee it will.
More in the Moment is coming up after the break on listener-supported SDPB Radio. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The colors and sounds of the 12th annual Native Pop Festival and Art Market saturated Rapid City's Main Street Square this past weekend. Native Pop is an annual gathering and juried art show where creators and collectors meet. Premier artists such as Wade Patton and Jada Gray Eagle, James Starr comes out, and Jennifer White were on the roster. SDPB's CJ Keene was there, and he brings you this report.
The artist reception and award ceremony was held at the Susie Kappa Gallery in downtown Rapid City Friday night, and the main show continued over the weekend. James Starr Comes Out was named Best in Show. A traditional artist, he says his art is an effort to keep touch with history in the year 2024.
The motivation of that is, just revitalizing the horse mass among the Lakota. Today, you do not see that very much, so, I feel as an artist, it's my obligation to, try to bring back some of the things to strengthen us as a people.
Starr Comes Out is an established Lakota artist, and many of his works can be seen in the Journey Museum's permanent collection. He says these types of events open up real doors to up-and-comers.
When I was younger, just emerging artists, I didn't have opportunities. And, I'm always trying to empower the younger artists and, give them the opportunity, and I see more of it today. And my work is based on cultural ways, stories, history, and that's where I get my inspiration from.
But not every artist falls into the traditional style. Starr Comes Out's son, Sheldon Starr, offers a unique take on what indigenous art can be.
Say I'm inspired by American 1980s, 90s, 2000s, kind of like pop culture stuff. And then, coming from my Oglala tribe, a lot of that geometric inspiration is also in there as well. I've been trying to do this profession for about 4 years now or so. I'm still considered emerging artist right now.
While the pastels, high contrast, and geometry might strike the viewer as more Miami Vice than Pine Ridge, it's the inclusion of themes and perspective that allows Starr to stay true to his roots and his work, beginning with the tradition of storytelling.
A lot of my parents' stories were from when they were teenagers, young adults, during that time period. But all movies, music, everything that I love just kind of comes from that era. And just that steering away from the stereotypical stuff, I guess you would call it. I respect it a lot, but that's not what comes out of my creative mind.
At the same time, other creators are firmly planted in the present day with their work. Jay White is a Sioux Falls-based artist and owner of the Post Pilgrim Gallery.
So this particular piece is called The Real Blood Tribe. This is a painting in regard to the audacity of neo-Nazis coming into our state of South Dakota and prodding themselves on our state capitol building, as well as Deadwood, and being masked the entire time.
While making a strong anti-fascist statement, White says the painting also reflects the commodification of stolen indigenous lands and the power of unity.
There are seven women on these horses, and they are ready to fight. They are vulnerable but strong, but they are the real blood tribe. And shame on you for thinking that you could use that word in vain. Well, I don't need to really worry about the sense of strength or anything like that. I sit on the shoulders of many strong women and men before me that have given me the courage to stand up and speak exactly how I feel.
On top of that, White has a challenge for any young artist trying to find that voice.
If you young people have something to say, I dare you to write it down, or I dare you to paint it and have fun with it. And go see art, steal from other artists, everybody does it. Don't be ashamed.
That sentiment is reflected by Native Pop Executive Director Ray Nez.
It's really prevalent, especially here in Rapid City, to have Natives who have their own art, to be able to display that and have their own place in the art world. I would say come down to the art market. You know, learn to talk to people. As much as, you know, most people don't think of it as an acquired skill, you have to get out there. You have to be able to approach someone and be able to say, hi, you know, how are you? And just start asking questions.
Images from the market can be found online at sdpb.org/news. I'm SDPB's CJ Keene in Rapid City.
Several South Dakota swimmers made a splash at the U.S. Olympic trials. They hit the water for a chance to compete at the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. SDPB's Jackson Dirks went to Indianapolis. He was in the stands for the trials, and he brings us this report.
Over 22,000 fans put their voices together to cheer on friends, family members, and competitors. Although this giant arena usually hosts NFL games, football was not being played today. Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis, Indiana, is hosting the Olympic swimming trials. Athletes in all sports must do well at trials like this to qualify for the Olympic Games in Paris this year. The trial was a popular event. Over 22,000 people attended it in late June, setting a world record for most fans attending a swim meet, USA Swimming says. Jenna Jorgensen is an Aberdeen, South Dakota native. She was there competing and soaking in the experience. She swam for her college, the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. She spoke later by phone that she felt a sense of community within the sport.
Probably when you walk outside and people know who you are and they ask you to sign something for them, that was probably like the biggest thing that I'll take with me, because I'm from Nebraska, no one's gonna know my name, but like walking out, people knew who I was and I was able to sign some little kids' gear, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Jorgensen is no stranger to the big swimming stage. She was named a first-team All-American at the Division I National Championships, where she placed 8th in the mile. She says that experience prepared her for the Olympic trials.
I think NCAA prepared me very well for trials, just because I swam against a lot of the girls that I was already swimming against at NCAA's. While the atmosphere is probably a little bit more exciting at trials with so many more people there, in the swim area, like with all the athletes, it was probably about the same, you know, like everyone's just kind of getting ready for their races.
She had personal best times in every event she swims, but the competition at this level is intense and she fell short of qualifying for the Olympic team. Like Jorgensen, nearly all the swimmers have competed at Division I colleges, the highest collegiate level. In fact, of the over 1,000 swimmers, only 9 are Division II athletes. Of those 9, only one was a woman. Bryn Greenwald is a swimmer for Augustana University. She says the event is unlike any meet she had swam at before.
Like, I didn't think the change in venue would change how it felt to be in a meet, because I'd watched an interview previously to getting there. I don't remember who it was, but someone asked them, like, how does it feel to swim in an NFL stadium? And they were like, well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just another pool. Like, it feels like a swim meet. And like, for me, it just did not feel that way at all. Like, I was awestruck the entire time.
Greenwald swam the 50 meter freestyle, the shortest event of the meet. She hoped to set a new personal best, but falls just short. Despite this, she says the meet has a more meaningful impact on her compared to a time on the board.
I feel like it kind of gave me more of a passion for swimming almost. And like, it sounds kind of stupid, because it's like, how can one meet in one singular 50 that took you 25 seconds like change that much? But like, I just like, it's been a long time since I've gotten done with a race and wanted to just get up and do it again and again and again and again. Like, I wanted to stay in that pool for as long as I physically could, and I have not had that feeling in so long.
Greenwald finished 56th, much higher than the 84th seed that she entered the meet with. No South Dakota swimmers qualified for the Olympics this year. The closest was former Aberdeen Swim Club member Michael Andrew, who previously qualified for the 2020 Olympics. He advanced to the finals in the 100 breaststroke and 50 freestyle events, but missed out on making the team. Nebraska swimmer and Aberdeen native Jenna Jorgensen says although she is missing out on a trip to the Paris Olympics, she is proud of herself.
It was like a dream ever since I was a little kid. You know, swimmers always look up to the Olympians during the Olympic years. Nebraska and South Dakota, they're not big swimming states. So I think it definitely helps out the sport of swimming in these states and gets more little kids kind of motivated to try and get to that level.
She says she'll still be cheering for Team USA when the Olympics kick off July 26. I'm SDPB's Jackson Dirks in Indianapolis.
South Dakota One Book author Trent Presler wraps his book tour today in Yankton and Vermilion. His memoir is called Little and Often. He began the tour in the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls. The full conversation is available now online. The book is the story of Presler's childhood in South Dakota and how he left the state to find a home in New York by the sea. After the death of his estranged father, Presler used his dad's tools to build a wooden canoe. Even though he had no boat building experience or training, the project became a metaphor for his grief. In this excerpt, I asked him about those tools, the canoe, his relationship with suffering, and his remarkable journey of writing a book.
Look, his tools are not a big deal. People make big deals about his tools. They were just like a rancher's toolbox, right? It was like some wrenches and chisels and hammers, and it was tired metalware that had never in its life imagined it would be used to build a boat. These are things that he used to as a farrier to work on horses' hooves and to build and repair barbed wire fences, right? So clamps and all kinds of stuff. But I was living on the ocean at the time, and it was this historic blizzard in February, and there were 4 feet of snow, and the bay froze over in front of my house, and I had this epiphany that I was going to use my dad's tools to build a boat so that when the water thawed, I could explore the sea. If the whole book is a metaphor, the tools are also, because this was, it wasn't as though, you know, I inherited some boat builder's cabinet full of the perfect tools for the occasion.
Right.
I had to make something out of nothing. That lesson became clear pretty early on. You weren't going to start and immediately finish. You also weren't going to start with one giant piece of wood and carve it down. To build a canoe, you have to layer it on piece by piece. And as painful as it is and as bloody as your knuckles get, eventually, if you just stick with it one piece at a time, you would get there. And that was my North Star that guided me through the process.
You're going to make every mistake that you can possibly make and go through Job level of suffering, which I do want to talk to you about, this concept of suffering, because this is one of the things that is central to your conversations with your parents that frustrate you about their faith, is their ability to embrace suffering and, well, if the Lord wills it, you know.
Right. We'll so be, it be. You know,
But as you go through this, you are suffering so much.
Yeah.
That I couldn't help but think again and again, like, how much is enough suffering for you?
Right.
Do you feel like you deserve this suffering? Can you not? I mean, I kept asking myself these questions. As you revealed as an author where you wanted me to go as a reader, that concept of suffering came up for me again and again, and I found incredibly potent in that.
Right.
What comes up for you when you think about the role of suffering in your life?
So, there have been times when I have believed, and I may even believe it right now, that if something comes too easy, it maybe isn't worth it, or maybe isn't worth as much, or maybe working hard for something and suffering is like the price you pay, is the penance, and maybe there is some metaphor there with Job and all of his sufferings in the Bible. It did always kind of frustrate me that, again, like I said before, if all of life had a simple answer when talking to mom and dad, that they can just say, well, it's God's will, right? And I would get so angry. How can that be? Because people don't like me for being gay, and do I have to suffer permanently now? Is this just like, am I in a permanent state of suffering because of other people? Basically a society that says that you're not okay. So is suffering necessary to make great art? I don't think so. You know, you're the first person that's asked me this question in such a meaningful way. And I have tried to put up flags with myself and with my husband too. I'll say if it seems like I'm suffering too much or putting myself in a position where like I'm making things harder than they need to be, to just kind of tap me on the shoulders. Because I think it is instinctual a little bit. They say your first love is sort of ingrained in you from a very young age, and your first love can be anything. It can be a person, it can be a hobby, and it can also be a state of mind, like suffering. And it can become generational, I think, if you experience loss repeatedly. Mm. So I just try to stay mindful of that. But yeah.
Is the writing hard for you as well? We see, if we read the book, the pain, the physical pain, you're gonna go through a lot physically. But when you were writing the book, when you realized, oh, okay, this is something I'm going to put on paper, what kind of writer are you?
Oh, God.
What is the craft like for you? Is it as painful as... Because I can infer some things based on how I see you build the canoe and then apply it to how I imagine that you would be as a writer. But tell me a little bit about how that translates for you.
Sure, writing is so hard. When I finished the canoe, I thought, well, that's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I'll never do anything harder than build a canoe with my dad's tools. And then I wrote a book, and that became the hardest thing I've ever done. Writing is like boat building in that you have to build it piece by piece, and it's not a painting. Writing is sculpture. So you're like, you're layering on pieces of wood or those clay sculptors that push pieces of clay on with their thumbs to make an image of something. And then you come back 2 days later and you kind of want to tear it apart and add new things and move things around. So as a writer, I have not yet found a magical way to be an author without some measure of suffering. I also remember the just like with the canoe, the experience of total elation when it's finally over and when you see the finished product. And being able to use the canoe or to see the book in print. And that's, again, like this sort of juicy morsel at the end of the journey where you're always trying to get back there to that feeling.
Trent Presler is the author of Little and Often. The memoir was chosen as this year's South Dakota One Book. His tour of the state concludes today in Yankton and Vermilion. But we'll see him again at the South Dakota Festival of Books in September. It's in Brookings this year. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, what does it mean to break bread with our elected officials? Alexander Heffner shares the table with political leaders searching for statesmanship in the midst of food culture and the dishes that define who we are. We've got a preview. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.